PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
From WNYC in New York, I'm Kurt Anderson. This time of year, we spend a lot of time in airports and dealing with all the airport hassles, too. The stocking feet security checks, long lines, flight delays, lousy in-flight movies. But not long ago, airports had a glamorous supporting role in our lives. The jet age was exciting.
The modern air terminal is designed for passenger convenience, with services available that help make air travel an integral part of the life of a nation on the go.
In February 1964, when the Beatles first touched down in America, they had their press conference fresh off the plane in front of the Pan Am logo at New York's brand new JFK Airport. In every city on their world tour that year, the airport was the venue for fan hysteria and the media circus.
Would you please sing something?
No! Sorry.
Next question.
No, we need money first.
Today in Studio 360, we are looking at the cultural hows and whys of the airport, why they look the way they look, how they make us feel, their singular melting pot mix of glamour and banality, and what artists and writers and designers make of them. Joining me is Pico Iyer. He is 16 hours ahead, literally tomorrow, in Japan, where he lives. He's a novelist and a journalist, and it has been said, just about the best travel writer working today. Pico Iyer, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, Pico, I guess I should confess that we've known each other a long time. We were writers together at Time Magazine in the 1980s. And my recollection of what happened is that one day you just flew off on an assignment and just kept flying and never came back.
Well, and I think that's partly a reflection of the fact I've been flying since birth. I actually went to school by plane. I was born in England and my parents moved to California when I was 7 or 8, and such were the curiosities of the exchange rate between the pound and the dollar then that we worked out it was in fact cheaper for me to fly across the North Pole 3 times a year to boarding school in England and fly back to see my parents 3 times a year in California than just to go to the local private school. So really, before I could talk or walk almost, I was living on planes, and they seemed a second home to me, to the point where settling down is the really difficult thing at this point.
At what age were you doing that round-the-world flight several times a year?
I started at 9 years old, and I think it was only a lot later that I realized that I was probably in the first generation of kids who were able to think of flying to school. And when I got to my English boarding school, many of the kids there had just flown from Lima or Buenos Aires or Hong Kong or Nairobi, all of us being kids taking it for granted, and only much later realizing this is something that would have seemed the stuff of science fiction to our parents.
Really? I mean, didn't you put on the rocket pack and go to London for the day or something?
No, well, yeah, then it just seemed like taking a train, though I can still remember vividly the process of getting on the plane in 1960s California, revolution breaking out all around me, black light posters in the air, Jerry Garcia riffs in the background, getting onto this plane and arriving 10 hours later, more or less in the 15th century, which is where my English school was, and feeling myself in the course of those 10 hours, literally and almost imperceptibly to myself, changing my accent, changing my attitudes, changing myself so that the person who got off the plane would be a different person from the one who'd got on. And I think it was a good lesson to me in how the airplane and the airport is the kind of spiritual center of the double life. And it was also a good training in seeing how the airport is, as you were saying, a wonderful sanctuary, because when I would arrive in Heathrow Airport, it was probably the only place in my life where I was not under the jurisdiction of my parents and not under the jurisdiction of my school. And since what was awaiting me in my school were formidable, aged women ready to inflict corporal punishment on me and men who were even worse, I just spent as long as I could, sometimes 15 hours or more, in Heathrow Airport. And for a little 9-year-old boy at loose in the world, the airport seemed the very spiritual heart of everything exotic.
That sounds absolutely thrilling to me. I mean, growing up in the middle of the country where a trip to an airport was literally like going to an amusement park or something because it was so exciting just to see planes landing. To be in an great international airport alone as a child must have been just astounding.
It was. I mean, amusement park is just the way to put it, sort of Tomorrowland and Fantasyland and Adventureland all at once.
My guest today is Pico Iyer, the acclaimed writer and world traveler, and we're talking about airports. Photographer Zoe Crosher also grew up around planes and terminals, so it's natural that for Crosher's latest photo project, she traveled to the airport in her adopted hometown, Los Angeles International, known as LAX. As KCRW's Matt Holtzman tells us, it was the fringes of the LAX universe that delivered some of her most intriguing images.
The Adventurer is a one-star tourist hotel 5 minutes east of LAX along Century Boulevard. It looks a little like one of those Mexican beach hotels where college kids go for spring break, only it's not as nice. I walk into the lobby of The Adventurer with Zoe Crosher, and we're both a little self-conscious. I mean, we're complete strangers checking into a cheap hotel in the middle of the afternoon. You do the math.
In the room I stayed last time, it's on the other side. It's kind of facing the back, so we've got a view of the planes coming into land.
We try to explain to the receptionist that Zoe's a photographer and that she took this great picture of a plane out the window of one of their rooms.
Okay. I did an art project that was from all the hotels and motels around LAX.
What did I do with
the... Oh, you gave it to the guy. And then I photographed from each one of the planes coming into land.
The room where Zoe originally took her picture isn't available because of a leak or something, so the receptionist gives us the room next door. We head out of the lobby towards the back of the hotel.
So, actually, last time when I looked, that's pretty amazing. There's a mist coming off the pool, the surface of the pool right now. Last time I came, there was some poor Australian guy who was working at the front desk, and it's always a question of how to ask for a room with a view without sounding like a terrorist, right?
All the pictures in Zoe's project, called Out the Window LAX, show a hint of a hotel room in the foreground and a plane out the window. In the picture she took from room 252 here at The Adventurer, you see a corner of a clunky old AC unit and a slice of striped curtains that have badly faded. That's all you need to see to know what kind of room it is. Out the window, there's a Qantas 747 hanging above a row of bent palm trees. Heading to the room, we pass by a bunch of video games under an awning, and Zoe stops to play a driving game called Maximum Speed.
Let's start. My mom's an airline stewardess, and I grew up as the daughter of a diplomat. That's my obsession with travel and transients and this whole airport thing anyway. That's the real backstory.
Zoe's mom and dad met on a flight from Frankfurt to New York, and he picked her up at the airport for their first date. Travel and airports and hotels were a big part of their family life, so Zoe took it for granted. But when she moved to L.A. as a grad student in 1998, the only travel she did was in her car. And that's where Out the Window LAX really began.
It started trying to navigate Los Angeles. It was a really strange experience initially because I had never driven so much. And everybody goes through their sort of initial phase of trying to figure out where you're going and how to get there. So I learned Los Angeles solely by Yahoo driving directions. And I had no idea where any of the streets actually were, truly in relation to one another, or how the city kind of functioned.
She tried to find the real Los Angeles the best way she knew how, through the lens of her camera. But she ended up taking pictures of what everybody thinks L.A. is like. Palm trees and sun and pools.
All the easy stuff, right. All the pretty easy surface glamour stuff, absolutely. And it didn't work. I was just taking nice pictures of the palm trees and the pool. And it was. It took me a while to figure out that I had to go that next step further and figure out what is L.A.
She found that next step after she spent the night with a friend in a hotel near LAX.
And it's literally like this beautiful, huge window just watching the planes coming into land. And they just kept coming in and kept coming in, and it felt like I was watching a movie because they literally are sort of screen-sized, these big windows, and you're just watching this motion unfold in front of you.
Zoe saw a way to use her love of travel to speak about L.A. in terms she could understand. So she mapped out Century Boulevard and started taking pictures of planes out the windows of the corporate hotels near the airport, the budget chains near the freeway, and the no-tell motels farther east. Up the concrete stairs, past an overgrowth of tropical plants, we finally make it to room 242 at The Adventurer. Just like in Zoe's picture of the room next door, there's the AC unit and the faded striped curtains. Looking out the window, you can really see what's normally just passing by the windows of our cars here in L.A., generic streets and stop signs and rows of apartment buildings. It could be Carson or Alhambra or Van Nuys.
Everything is so spread out and dissipated and kind of transitory, and there's no there. But the LAX project is actually pointing that there is a there, even though it doesn't seem like there's a there.
Just then, a huge white 747 with a red kangaroo on its tail slowly passes by the window of our room, just over the tops of the palm trees.
Look at it. There it is. That's the one that I shot. That's the Aussie one again. Did you see? The airport and the idea of travel were just sort of vehicles through which to talk about L.A. It was one avenue of investigating Los Angeles and the things about L.A. that inspire me and get me excited and I think are problematic. But yeah, it is about L.A. It's a documentary of L.A.
But Out the Window LAX is a documentary specifically about the L.A. we drive through every day, but we never really see. For Studio 360, I'm Matt Holzman.
You can see some of Zoe Crocher's work at studio360.org. Pico Iyer is my guest today, and we're talking about airports. Pico, when she talked about how seeing the big jumbo jets pass by the motel room window is like watching a movie, I'm reminded that anytime I'm driving past one of the New York airports and a huge plane comes, 50 feet over my car, I kind of am simultaneously weirded out and find it hilarious. It's like this great big special effect has occurred in my life. And her pictures sort of remind me of that strange, out-of-scale moment.
Yes. I mean, I think one of the moments I liked in that section was when she did the driving simulation machine, because airports, as you say, are all about simulation. I actually, you may not know this, but I did this absolutely crazy masochistic thing a few years ago, which was to go and live in Los Angeles Airport for 1 or 2 weeks. And I remember sometimes as I was wandering around the terminals, already in something of a deranged state, I'd come upon a whole group of men in suits and backpackers getting ready, assembling around a gate to take off. And then I'd look around and I'd see there were people around them with microphones and Warner Brothers t-shirts. And I realized that this actually was a movie. And every other scene that you witness around Los Angeles Airport, in fact, is not from real life, but is from that alternative reality that LA specializes in. Even when you go and see a movie like Red Corners, the Richard Gere film set in Beijing, they actually recreated the old hutongs of Beijing in the immediate vicinity of Los Angeles Airport. And so I think LAX, more than anywhere, dissolves one's sense of whether one's in real life or in some parallel universe.
Have you seen the Steven Spielberg, Tom Hanks movie, The Terminal?
I have. And I think it played upon two things that hit me very forcibly when I was more or less living on the airport. One is the curious sense that the airport is a place where we spend more time waiting than anywhere else, except perhaps a hospital. There's nothing to do except in an airport except wait, and most people don't want to be in an airport. And there's a curious quality of time and therefore of emotional experience in an airport where you're waiting and waiting and waiting for hours on end, and there's suddenly a rush of experience as you board the plane. It's almost like those basketball games where the final 15 seconds take about 15 minutes to play out on TV. Time itself gets stretched in the airport because of all that waiting. And then the other thing that I responded to a lot in the Spielberg film was his notion that the immigrants who arrive in American airports, usually full of dreams, in some sense never leave the airport. In his movie, they're actually stranded in this transit zone. But when I was spending time in Los Angeles Airport, after a little while, I would notice that almost all the people working at the airport were from Ethiopia or El Salvador or Guatemala. Many of them had arrived in Los Angeles Airport perhaps a couple of years before, hoping to claim the opportunity and the affluence for which America is a byword. And at some level, they'd found that they could never get beyond that terminal. They could never actually set foot in real America and were confined to working and living around the airport more or less permanently. And of course, his film draws on the fact that there are many people who professionally live in airports. I know one of the terminals in Moscow's airport features in the UN High Commission for Refugees reports every year as one of the major refugee states in the world, because at any given time, there are quite a few people living in Moscow airport.
So whether or not airports reflect their cities, they come to affected and concentric circles because neighborhoods of workers and immigrants and all the rest, I guess, you know, arise around them.
Exactly. And neighborhoods of people eager to prey on foreigners. I think the thing I never expected until I spent that time in LAX was how many criminals, how many shady characters are floating around the terminals, because they know that half the people there have just arrived, they're jet lagged, they're culture shocked, they've never set foot in America before, they don't know the rules. And so there are women dressed as nurses, others are soliciting money for the Church of the Soldiers of Christ. There are Louis Farrakhan operatives, there are of course Hare Krishna people, there are men who go from table to table in the cafeterias handing out little globes that say, "I am a deaf." And just as you're thinking, oh, how nice to get a free present, you see on the other side of the globe, "Please pay me a dollar." And although I quickly would identify that as a scam, I think many, an innocent just arrived from Taiwan or Japan, would say, oh, you know, we have to pay this person. And so the airport becomes this field. I mean, it's a global village in miniature, partly because all the cultures of the world are brought together on one common, under one common roof, but they have no common language and no common understanding, and people are trying to turn the misunderstanding to advantage often.
And do you buy the premise of Zoe Crocher's project that LAX has something particular to say about the nature of Los Angeles transience and sort of transportation obsession?
Very much so. It's 8 terminals without really a center. The very code for it, LAX, sounds like a bad joke that somebody might make about Los Angeles. The streets around Los Angeles Airport are called Aviation Boulevard and Skyway and Flight Avenue. And Los Angeles, more than anywhere I know, is about floatingness and rootlessness. I actually stayed in some of those hotels that Zoe was describing. I went for drinks at this place called the Proud Bar, just near Los Angeles Airport, where you can put on headphones and actually listen to air traffic controllers. And it is a remarkable city in itself, as I never would have known until I spent time there. 50,000 people work in LAX, which is twice as many people as live in the country of Monaco. It's an amazing universe. There are fire stations and hospitals and police agencies. And that was why I felt that if one wants to see where our urban culture is going, a place like LAX or maybe JFK is how you can travel in time and really see where we'll be 15 years from now.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and my guest today is Pico Iyer. In a moment, a mariachi band soothes the savage breast on the other side of the metal detectors. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International.
From the Oakland Airport runway, ears popping, cleared his head. Organized and used up, too tired to be depressed. Thirsty for some fruit juice and anxious for his next flight. Back to the city.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 with the journalist and novelist and world traveler Pico Iyer, and we're talking about airports. No period was shakier for airports than the days and weeks right after September 11, 2001. At Baltimore's BWI Airport, things got particularly nuts. Washington's National Airport was shut down, so the Baltimore terminals were filled with long lines of stressed out, anxious, rerouted passengers. And the Baltimore Airport administrators tried something unorthodox. They literally sent in the clowns and the jugglers and dancers and celebrity impersonators to try to pacify the 9/11 crowds. Gregory Warner has the story.
Imagine an airport with lines stretching a quarter mile long, and it's really quiet. And it's a few weeks after 9/11, and you're wearing a Groucho Marx costume, and it's your job to make everyone feel better. And no one really knows if it's okay to laugh yet. Performer Michael Levick says it was a tough crowd.
People were nervous, people were frightened, unhappy. So there was a lot of tension, and you can play any crowd after the third drink, but it's that first hour of any party that you can't, I mean, you're pulling teeth, you know. Of course, you've always got that, you know. Anybody seen the Jewels? Or Charles. Charles has got the Jewels, and everybody knows it.
He mocked families with their bags, security guards with guns.
At the counters there, I just walk out, I only came to say I must be going.
The more absurd the jokes, the better. After all, the real Marx Brothers hit their peak in the Great Depression. And the idea of this, too, was a sort of massive distraction campaign. Betsy Samperi ran the airport's community outreach at the time.
Anything that I could think of that would take people's mind off standing in line, we did. So I had flamenco dancers with a floor. Every 15 minutes, we'd move them to different spots. We had mariachis, again, who worked the lines. We had a dance couple who actually went up to people, took them out of the line for a minute, and gave them a dancing lesson.
For the entertainers, a job soothing anxious travelers after 9/11 seemed almost patriotic. And all kinds of performers heeded the call.
Normally, my situations are more like a lecture hall or a ballroom.
Alain New has performed for Al Gore and George Bush, and he's not used to the street hustle.
In this situation, it was really sort of like guerrilla theater.
Mr. New calls himself a mentalist, which means he uses weird science and psychological suggestion to do things like bend spoons. Recently, he offered to demonstrate, so we scoured the busy airport for an audience willing to sit for a trick, ending up at last in the USO lounge with a cadre of the U.S. Air Force waiting for a flight overseas. A war movie blared on the TV, a poker game was stalled on the table, and the airman nearest Mr. New was a Baptist from Oklahoma who said he didn't believe in magic. Soon enough, Alain was rolling up his sleeves. He's a wiry guy, but with huge hands and forearms. And an ordinary metal spoon started really bending and twisting between his fingers.
You start to see it starting to buckle and warp without any effort whatsoever. In fact, it becomes a chain reaction. Every single spoon starts to go simultaneously. Now check this out. This is the one that you drew on, right?
Then he made the spoon bend while someone else held it. A crowd began to gather. Alain never calls what he does magic. He'd rather be seen as a wacky physics teacher who knows some neat tricks. But in the airport after 9/11, people wanted a prophet, not a professor.
People would shake my hand, people would touch me, people would like ask for my predictions of whether or not their plane was going to, whether or not they were going to be okay. Everybody was looking at other people, you know. A guy might pull me aside and say, what do you think of that guy over there, you know, and point to like a guy, and I'd have to like look at him and say, totally harmless. And it was a weird dynamic.
It's hard to measure just what Alain and Groucho and the others provided. Was it a temporary distraction or something more? All we have to go on are little moments. Like at the end of this performance, I watch Alain hand over the mangled spoon to one of the airmen as a good luck charm. I wonder if, wherever she is now, she still has it with her. For Studio 360, this is Greg Warner.
And I'm Kurt Anderson with the writer Pico Iyer. We're talking about airports. Pico, did September 11th change your personal airport experience over the last 3 years?
I think it just heightened an unsettledness that for me has always been there. I should tell your listeners that I, being of Indian background, fit perfectly the terrorist profile. I have dark skin, I'm of the right age, I'm of the right background. And so to this day, every time I go to my quiet little airport in Santa Barbara, California, every time I'm sitting waiting for my flight, people are looking around their shoulders nervously at me and edging away from me and clearly wishing that I weren't there. And so in that sense, it's changed my experience a bit because I could be from the Middle East. But my sense is that airports, partly because there's so much security there, have always been great centers of insecurity. When I was spending time around Los Angeles Airport before September 11th, I learned that there are 10 private security agencies just working the international terminal. And I remember I once talked to a man, a Pakistani man, who was working one of the security checks, and he said, everyone around is undercover. There are 350 undercover people around. You could be undercover. I could be undercover. Who knows? And in some ways, he was touching on the fact that we're at a loss in airports, and we don't know who's surrounding us, and we don't know who's watching us. And I think, you know, you really see people at the far edges of themselves in terms of anxiety when they're at the airport, even before 9/11, and 9/11 has just kind of turned that into 20-point bold.
It astounds me, Pico, that you say you are unnerved or at loose ends in airports. I figured that this childhood kind of catechism and being in airports all the time had somehow suited you for airport life, and that's why you're a travel writer. But you don't dig airports so much?
No, I feel completely at home in airports. Probably left to my own devices, I'd live in an airport and a hotel for the rest of my life. It's the one scene of public life that is the stage for our most private moments, by which I mean people are having life-changing experiences in airports. They're sending their sons off to war. They're taking off on honeymoons. They're meeting parents that they haven't seen in 50 years and have thought they'd never see again. And so it's almost as if these great dramas out of Aeschylus or Shakespeare of romance and rescue from war and reunion, they're all playing out in public and in this absolutely placeless space of Starbucks and McDonald's and the Body Shop. And there's some sense in which human dramas are meeting a kind of post-human space in airports. And I think people can feel unsteadied inherently because nothing around them is that reassuring except the fact that they're seeing the golden arches yet again.
One of the things that I found most interesting about that piece about the Baltimore airport was not so much the 9/11 specific stuff, but just the idea of there being performers wandering around in an airport, which, as you say, is so placeless and kind of anodyne and antiseptic. I wonder if that would be a good or a bad thing to install in any given airport on a regular permanent basis.
Sounds like a wonderful thing to me. Weapons of mass distraction, really. And I think airports in their own way are trying to do that. I mean, it's remarkable now if you think about it. Airports have microbreweries and mini golf courses in them. They have hiking trails and rainforests and swimming pools. They know that they have a captive audience, and so they're trying to find ways in which to divert people and also to get their money out of them while they're waiting there. But I think clowns would be an eminently good idea. And again, it's one of the things that hit me when I stayed in LAX that, for example, Dallas-Fort Worth Airport alone is larger than the whole of Manhattan. I mean, airports are covering huge spaces, and people are in this condition in which they're looking for sedatives. The kind of shops that you see most often in airports are either selling flight insurance or, you know, the spiritual equivalent. That's why all the churches gather there, because they know that people are unclaimed and craving reassurance in some ways.
Well, and now that you can't smoke in most airports, I'm sure they crave reassurance all the more. But where is that rainforest in the airport?
I think it may be in Kuala Lumpur, which again, Kuala Lumpur is not the most affluent or sophisticated town, as you know, and yet they've created one of the finest airports in the world and somehow managed to try to rewire their whole image to the world just through having this fabulous 22nd century space.
My guest today is the writer Pico Iyer, and we're talking about a place where a lot of us this holiday season have spent some time recently, airports. We have been discussing jet travel to and from big metropolitan airports around the world, but across rural America, amateur pilots and crop dusters use a huge network of hundreds or probably thousands of little general aviation airports, sometimes consisting of just an airstrip and an office. Hal Humphreys visited 10 Charlie, which is an airport in rural Illinois, and discovered its owner, Michael Standard, was living a kind of double life.
Michael Standard runs a design firm in the tiny village of Bull Valley, Illinois. He made the move from Chicago about 5 years ago. Standard and his design team create labels and packaging for clients like Sealy and ReadyWhip. When you visit Standard at his office, the first thing you notice... is the runway. Standard's design firm is in an airport, not a big commercial hub like O'Hare. This place has a barn and a silo. The runway is only 36 feet wide and barely 3,000 feet long. The security gate looks like it hasn't been closed in decades. The airport office looks like an old control tower, two stories with windows all around the second floor. Standard got to know the property because he's also a pilot, owns a vintage Piper Apache. That's a slick twin engine. Standard used to bring his plane to Galt Field for maintenance and fuel.
We would often drive out here on the weekends or some night, sometimes in the evening, to visit the airplane to see what was moving forward or to kind of visit it like it was in a hospital. But by driving up to visit the place, we would drive in here in this old area that was once a pool added onto the house, which was falling apart with raccoons living in it. And I said, but that would make a great studio there. But that would be a pretty big step to make. But so one thing led to another.
And he bought the whole thing. Standard fell in love with the place, old farmhouse, neglected hangars, airport and all. After cleaning out the pool, gently relocating the raccoons, 18 months of renovations, and convincing everyone that he had not, in fact, lost his mind, Standard opened his new office. He renamed his studio after the airport's FAA identifier, the studio at 10 Charlie. The studio window, an entire wall of clear story glass, overlooks the airport. Standard strolls from his design studio to the airport office almost every day to check on business.
Well, I'm not sure what I do anymore. I have a degree in visual communication, graphic design. I run the airport, and I have staff. There's sometimes as many as 14 people here, depending on the season. Yeah, so I run both businesses.
Standard says keeping track of the airport, three mechanics, a full line staff, maintenance crew, and running a design firm is a challenge.
Because they're just not connected usually. Pilots are a breed apart, you know, and designers are too. So I had to alter my personality really to get to master flying. It's just not, when I first got into flying, I had this idea that flying was about freedom and about, getting up there and soaring like a bird or something. That's not at all what it's about. It's very disciplined. You fly the numbers. I come into the pattern at a certain altitude. Well, everything's precise. It's not at all a creative act, and that surprised me because I thought it was more a free-spirited thing.
More and more, Standard's trying to combine his graphic design skills with his love of aviation.
I know a lot about aviation. I have an affinity for it. I may be, given what I do in marketing and design and advertising, whatever it is I do, there aren't too many people in the country who have the skills I have in communication and the understanding and knowledge of the aviation business.
After giants like Boeing and Cessna, small companies make up the bulk of the general aviation industry. And lots of these small companies leave their graphic design to the engineers or a secretary, or even a niece who likes to draw. Basically, the graphic design side of aviation is best described as second-rate futuristic.
There was a time in America where design was more heroic.
Standard loves classic design, like the old American Airlines logo with its blue eagle and two red A's. It's instantly identifiable. Standard landed the gig to design a new logo for American Champion Aircraft, one of the few companies still building tube and fabric airplanes. The Citabria and the Decathlon are classic airplanes. They look like the good old days, graceful and beautiful. Standard loved the planes, but the company logo didn't fit.
So here's a trademark that this company had done. It really wasn't worth noticing. It was just done in a really haphazard kind of way. So I thought it should look forever. And then what I did was I incorporated these initials, ACA.
Standard took the original ACA logo, which featured three letters on a field of metallic silver with three shooting stars, red, white, and blue, and tossed everything but the ACA letters in the original font. The new mark looks like a big shoulder patch with wings, like one of those old flight jacket patches from World War II.
I had this feeling about how they should look. I did this American Champion mark in such a way that I could reach back in time and it would always have been there. You know, that's just what I'm about. I'm not interested. I have no personal statement to make as a design professional.
gazing due east, staring straight down the barrel of the parallel taxiway of Galt Field, an airport that looks like it's been here forever. Standard says the move to the country, to this old airstrip, is all part of his own design.
So the flying is it's just a very strange combination of things, graphic design and aviation, you know. When I look at the design I'm working on ultimately is the design of my life. And, you know, that's the ultimate design, in my opinion.
For Studio 360, I'm Hal Humphreys.
And I'm Kurt Anderson, talking today with the writer and extremely frequent flyer, Pico Iyer. Pico, are you familiar with little rural all-American airports like that?
I'm familiar with little rural global airports, maybe more than all-American. One of the first ones that comes to my mind is the airport in fact, Easter Island. It's a single strip. It sees a plane that arrives at 3 a.m, perhaps 2 or 3 times a week. The only way it manages to seduce its new arrivals is to have a couple of stone heads of the kind we associate with Easter Island placed around this tiny squat terminal building and out in the runway. So you arrive in this single runway little airport that's smaller actually than the one in Santa Barbara, California. You walk into the terminal, people are dressed in grass skirts. There are a few eerie stone statues peering at you through the darkness, and then you're in absolute emptiness. And there's some sense in which every time you arrive in an airport, it can feel as if it's a lunar experience, or you're not sure whether you've arrived in spacecraft Apollo or just on a regular United Airlines shuttle.
Well, in one of my, I recall 30 some years ago now, one of my favorite moments when I saw 2001, A Space Odyssey, the first time, was the airport nature, the futuristic, cool, sleek airport quality of where these people took off for, interplanetary trips was one of the most sort of perfect glimpses of the future, I thought, in that film.
Yes, and I think the first time I realized I was in the 21st century was when I stepped into the new airport in Hong Kong, which is, I think it was designed by Sir Norman Foster, as you know, and he thought of it as a cathedral to the religion of movement and transience and floatingness. And it's all very gray and black and sleek, and it looks the way a sort of Armani suit or a BMW looks. There are 140 stores there, and somehow you it's as if you've landed inside a screen and you finally made it into a terminal in the sense of being inside a computer terminal almost, and you are a piece of data within this futuristic grid. And there's a kind of excitement as well as a kind of eeriness to that.
Well, it's interesting. Airports are the final great place, it seems to me, where modernist architects like Sir Norman Foster can kind of go all out and do the purest work that they were born to do as modernists.
Exactly. With enormous budgets. I mean, this one cost $15 billion. And I know, for example, Rem Koolhaas has been working on that structure in Lille, in Europe, because there is the sense that people aren't living in places anymore. They're living in the state of movement. They're living in the spaces between real places. And so a train station, or especially an airport, has more urgency in our lives often than the homes that we occupy. I mean, for myself, I worked out a few years ago that I spend 40 days of every year either in an airplane or an airport. So that would come to 6 weeks of a year, which extrapolated across my lifetime could come to 8-10 years of my life. And my friends who are in business travel much more than I do. So they may spend 15 years of their lives in these nowhere spaces. And so for architects, it's a chance not just to design their own lives, as in that last segment, but to design our lives. I mean, they are crafting the world in which we will live for 15 years of our lives.
So you having – that's an astonishing calculation you've done. It really reminds me that you are one of this species of new, entirely globalized world citizens, I guess.
Yes, which I think is the signature tune of the 21st century. I wrote that book called The Global Soul, partly about the sense that there's a new human being coming to light in the new century, who's almost living in the psychological equivalent of cyberspace. And his spiritual home is the airport. And I also often found that, for example, when I was flying from, let's say, Santa Barbara to Easter Island, I think a lot about Santa Barbara, my home. I think a lot about Easter Island, this exotic destination. And yet the kind of encounters and emotions I would see in L.A. Airport en route were ultimately much more interesting than anything I would see at the other end in Easter Island. Really, the airport had become this locus for transformation and drama of every kind.
Pico Iyer is my guest today, and we're talking about airports. In a minute, we visit an airport where you can check out the Rembrandts after you check your bags. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Well, I'm Kurt Anderson, and happily I'm not in an airport because actually being paged like that would terrify me. I'm in Studio 360 with the writer and world traveler Pico Iyer, and we're talking about airports. It's interesting, as we've talked, you have recurrently talked about airports in sort of spiritual terms and about the sort of transformative experiences that they can supply even without us knowing it. Do you feel, as somebody who spends as many hours and days and weeks a year as you do in airports, that you are permanently changed in sort of some small or larger way?
I think permanently jet-lagged. I often think of an airport as a monastery in reverse, because an airport is one of the most impersonal places, and I think many of us begin to feel impersonal, as if we've lost our personality when we're there. But it's not in the higher spiritual transcendent sense of impersonality that maybe a monk would feel. It's just the sense of being reduced to zero. So I do find them actually rather dispiriting places, and I've spent a lot of time investigating the state of jet lag, which is almost the neurological equivalent of one of those long gray passageways in an airport. And it's not quite a dream state, and it's not quite a drug state, but it's certainly an altered state. But I don't think it's we're being altered for the better when we're jet-lagged. I think, again, like the very fact of being in airports, it's some new shift of the modern era that we haven't stopped to think about, but that is really having a fundamental effect. I think maybe what your question is getting at, too, is the sense, and this is one of the interesting things about the airport, that we're not ourselves there. Sometimes it's because we don't know who we are or where we are when we've landed after a long trip. Sometimes it's because people can easily pretend to be other people when they're traveling or even when they're just going to the airport. And it's almost as I walked around Los Angeles Airport, I felt I could see people composing selves and decomposing selves and acting parts that weren't their own. It has this kind of singles bar quality of people meeting other strangers and giving them whole life stories and whole identities that may not be their own, which they can continue for the 6 hours of their meeting or the 10 hours of a flight.
When one looks at paintings, impressionist paintings of the 19th century, Monet and others painted the great, grand, new technological marvels of the train station again and again. Do you think airports in our last half century or today can or have provided anything like that sort of inspiration to either visual artists or writers?
I think they may in the next generation. People like Zoe, who are just waking up to the fact that these are such significant backdrops and destinations in our lives, and that they are destinations in themselves rather than just thoroughfares. And I can see a whole new kind of art. I mean, I was thinking before talking to you what kind of music would be ideal for an airport, and I think Brian Eno and certain kinds of ambient or techno music in some ways are recreating the airport experience orally for us. I used to think that airports bear the same relation to life that Muzak does to music. And yet they do have their own kind of integrity and mood that I can imagine artists are wanting to try to capture.
Pico Iyer, thank you very much. You have been a perfect guest.
Thank you so much. I've been really enjoying talking to you.
Pico Iyer's latest book is called Sun After Dark, and it includes an entire chapter on jet lag. He is also the editor of the Best American Travel Writing of 2004. You can find out more about him at studio360.org. Lovely and very subtle piece of music you're hearing is actually the first track from Brian Eno's 1978 classic of ambient music, Music for Airports. You may be breathing a sigh of relief this weekend. The holidays are over, so no more sing-alongs with colleagues or family for another year. It isn't easy trying to get through Jingle Bells or Auld Lang Syne with Uncle John or Sally from up in payroll who couldn't carry a tune if it had handles. Or maybe you are Sally from payroll. You apologetically mutter that you're tone-deaf or, well, take heart. Chances are you are not tone-deaf. You just sing badly, which is something else entirely. True tone deafness is actually pretty rare. Jeff London talked with some scientists trying to unlock the mystery of the condition technically called congenital amusia.
Gigi is a 64-year-old retired engineer from Hungary, fluent in several languages, highly educated and highly cultured, but he's never enjoyed music.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear John. Happy birthday to you.
Gigi, his name remains anonymous since he's a participant in a scientific case study, is profoundly tone-deaf. Cincinnati Conservatory professor Stephen Kahn is co-author of that study.
He said that he did have a musical education, but that music sounded to him like a car door slamming. It didn't do him any good. And this was very surprising. I'd never heard anyone say something quite so bold as that.
Neuropsychologist Isabel Peretz uses the term congenital amusia to describe this condition, where people have suffered a lifelong inability to appreciate, memorize, or perceive music. She's been studying amusia at the University of Montreal. Peretz says she's placed ads in newspapers and on the radio and gotten a lot of replies, but many of the people just sing badly and aren't really tone deaf. Only 3 or 4% of the population has amusia.
We have a questionnaire, and so one of the critical questions is, do you know if you sing in or out of tune? And if they say, I don't know, I can't tell, but other people told me. That's one criterion. The other criterion is that they are unable to recognize familiar music like, you know, happy birthday, if there are no words.
See, I really couldn't sing. I could never really sing. What I couldn't do was
sing.
I have trouble with those. It goes all around my... It's a terrifying...
People with congenital amusia typically avoid listening to music or going to concerts, says Gottfried Schlaug, a professor of neurology at the Harvard Medical School.
They still see, so like, the social benefits of it, so they may play CDs when they have guests over, but they would never actually do this for their own enjoyment.
Schlaug is also studying amusia and says it's a very specific disorder. While undergoing functional magnetic resonance imaging on their brains, subjects perform a battery of simple musical tasks, testing pitch direction, whether something's going up or down, and interval sizes, whether notes are close to each other or far apart. One test asks the subject to listen to a phrase of music, then hear another phrase, and say whether the second phrase is the same or different than the first. People with amusia can't do this at all. When you ask people with normal musical perception to do this kind of task, the right auditory cortex, located in the temporal lobe, lights up. So when Isabel Peretz began studying amusia, she thought that's where the problems would show up.
The surprise finding is that we don't find any anomaly in the auditory cortex at all. I mean, they seem to be functioning normally. But we did detect anomalies, but not in the auditory cortex.
Instead, she found anatomic differences in the right frontal lobe, the area where short-term memories reside, kind of like the RAM buffer of a computer. Gottfried Schlaug's studies, on the other hand, found anomalies in the left frontal lobe, an area of the brain that plays a role in perceptual tasks as well as language.
It may not matter as much if it is on the left or on the right, but this inferior frontal region is an interesting region because it may actually have both a perceptual part and an executive part. So it may actually use the sensory input to direct some sort of output.
Which means there seems to be some sort of break in the brain's feedback circuitry. People with amusia not only have a problem discriminating the pitches they hear, they also have a problem reproducing them.
Oh, say, can you see?
Of course, it's not so easy for anyone to sing the Star-Spangled Banner, but for Gigi, it's completely impossible. Research on amusia is still in its infancy, so scientists are trying to come up with next steps to study the condition.
The most remarkable feat of all would be to find somebody with congenital amusia and train them and see if there is potential to develop some musical, at least appreciation, move from no enjoyment, avoidance, to some enjoyment and some significance from music.
For Studio 360, I'm Jeff London.
When I heard the news this week that Susan Sontag had died, she was only 71, I felt both the cultural loss and some personal sadness. She had been with me here in Studio 360 a couple of years ago. As the U.S. was preparing then to invade Iraq, we were producing a show about war, and we decided that Susan Sontag would be the perfect guest. Actually, she would have been a great guest for Studio 360 almost any week. She was, after all, the great American public intellectual of her time, the essayist and novelist and theater director who knew so much and had so much to say that was interesting and valuable about the culture. It was 30 years earlier, when I was in college, that I first read Susan Sontag, an essay called Notes on Camp. It was staggeringly smart and showed me a fresh, rigorous, freewheeling way of thinking about aesthetics and sensibility. I had never encountered such an exciting, bracing gush of pure thought. I immediately understood why she had such a reputation. I still think it's one of the most important essays written in the last half century. And so when she agreed to come here in 2003 to talk about war, I was really nervous. I was so eager to prove to her that Studio 360 was worthy of her. We had a great conversation, a real conversation. We disagreed, we agreed, we probed, we laughed. She was demanding as a conversationalist, but generous, wide awake, engaged. You could hear her mind working in real time, like when I asked her how her 2 years in Sarajevo during the Bosnian War had made her completely rethink her earlier famous theory about how modern people had become jaded toward images of war and brutality.
Well, I don't think it's true. And I guess I like to argue with myself and, well, not because I just like to argue myself, because I like to think that I have a better view, that my experience teaches me something. If we don't learn from our experience, then well, what else can we learn from? And I think my view, which I think has been influential, is too simple. I don't think we just become inured or desensitized. I think it's a much more complicated process. And I think if people do feel turned off or indifferent to images of horror and war and suffering that they see and that they feel indignant about, I think it comes not because they're blasé, but because they feel impotent or powerless. And I think that's a perfectly understandable reaction.
So in a sense, your change of heart about the power of images to portray war and atrocity, it represents kind of a disillusioning or a reillusioning. Or...
Well, that's a very clever way of putting it. A disillusioning, yes. The disillusionment. That's right. That's absolutely right.
Arguing with herself, she said. And here, after winning the argument with herself a quarter century later, admitting she had been wrong before. Amazing. Another thing I admired about her was her ferocity against sentimentality, against simple black and white thinking of any kind. Like when, in our conversation, we were talking about the differences between the good guys and the bad guys in war.
Who said that wicked people don't have family lives or have good taste in music? Monsters don't come with signs over their heads saying, I'm a monster, and then they don't participate in any other human activities. I think we have to understand that it's human beings who do this, and we have to stop being surprised. It's really the beginning of being an adult, I think, not to be surprised. We can have every other reaction. We shouldn't be surprised.
Susan Sontag was not always solemn. Notes on Camp is the Rosetta Stone of a certain kind of comic, ironic sensibility. But she was a deeply serious person. Near the end of our conversation, I asked her why, in the face of the monstrous and ugly facts of life, war and human suffering, we need to care about mere plays or stories or paintings.
What finally matters to me about the arts, whether it's literature or film or other dramatic arts or music or dance, is the way it deepens us, the way it extends our feelings and tenderness and compassion and the ability just to recognize everyone's humanity, because in the end, the most important thing is that we are all human beings, including the people that commit these wicked acts.
We will miss Susan Sontag. I'm Kurt Anderson, and you have been listening today to Studio 360. I do hope you'll join us again for next week's program. Studio 360 is co-produced by WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
David Krasnow,
Lital Mulad,
Michelle Siegel,
Ave Carrillo,
Eric Malinsky,
Kate Saramek,
Alexis Schoenberg,
Lauren Shea.
Our theme music was composed by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Studio 360 is also supported by individual donors to PRI, whose contributions help bring innovation to public radio.
PRI. Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, art invades the office.
Ooh, look at these. These are called rubber fingertips. And they're really weird looking, and oh, they feel funny too. And I could see a whole bunch of those together doing something weird with a light inside.
Larissa Brown makes art out of desktop junk. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI.